Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. Welcome. Thanks for joining us. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm thrilled to be moderating today's webinar on assessing the impact of CELA law v. CFPB on the credit and collection industry. The Supreme Court's decision to hear arguments in this case has the potential to reshape the leadership structure of the CFPB, and that could have a significant impact on how the credit and collection industry is regulated. I'm thrilled to bring to you a panel of leading compliance experts today to discuss the potential ramifications of this case and how it could affect the ARM industry in both the short and long term. This webinar is being generously sponsored by WebRecon. You get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use, and it's a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now, let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. John Bedard is a nationally recognized authority on the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and the Fair Credit Reporting Act. He serves as counsel to several professional trade associations, including the Georgia Collectors Association. John is a former member of the board of directors of the industry's leading professional trade organization, ACA International. He serves as the state of Georgia compliance chairperson for ACA International and as a former chairperson and program designation award recipient of ACA International's members attorney program. Stephanie Jackman is the leader of Ballard Spahr's debt collection team and partner in Ballard's Atlanta office. She is nationally recognized for her expertise with respect to applying debt collection laws across all segments of the financial services industry, including traditional financial products, fintech and online lending, healthcare and student lending. She brings her collections compliance and litigation experience to bear in assisting her financial services industry clients facing state and federal government investigations and examinations, counseling them on complex compliance issues, assisting with debt portfolio acquisition diligence, and defending them in individual and class action lawsuits. Joanne Needleman is the leader of the Consumer Financial Services Regulatory and Compliance Group at Clark Hill. She is a past president of the board of directors of the National Creditors Bar Association and also served on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's Consumer Advisory Board. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them as the discussion is ongoing and when it has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available later today on AccountsRecovery.net. Finally, before I launch into the discussion, I want to ask everybody to take a minute and fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over today. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Your participation helps me develop content that's what you're looking for, much like the one we have, the topic we have for you today, and to find the speakers you want to hear from, which are very much the people we have before you today. So with that, let's get to our discussion. And Stephanie, you win panelist roulette. Your screen, you're up on my screen right now, so I'm going to give you the honor of the first question. Let's take a look at what this case is about, and then maybe we'll drill down from there.
Sure, and thank you. And I am so fortunate to be the first one that popped up on your screen, given that I imagine the rest of my panelists know exactly the outcome here. And, you know, we're going to share that with you later. But one thing we do know is that the CELA law case has been granted its petition for certiorari with the Supreme Court, and that the Supreme Court right now intends to hear arguments in that case on two key issues. The first is whether the CFPB, as it is currently structured with a single director who is removable for cause, is constitutional. And that's probably not surprising to anybody. We've heard and seen different articles over the years saying this is coming up from time to time, and people have had lots of thoughts, opinions, and discussions. But what was interesting, at least in my view, I don't know how it struck the other panelists, but for me, seeing that the Supreme Court also would like to hear arguments on the severability of that portion of the Title 10 of the Dodd-Frank Act, not just from Title 10 itself, which is where the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was created, but from the larger statute. So that's interesting. And that's something that I know I've been reflecting on, and I think some of my panelists have as well. So maybe they have some thoughts to share on whether that's interesting to them too.
Well, this is Joanne. Thank you, Stephanie. Always great to be on a call with you and John. I feel fortunate to be here. And thank you, Mike and Web Recon. I agree, Stephanie. I thought it was really interesting because it's always been about, and if you recall the PHH case, the first go around of PHH with just the panel deciding that the for cause provision was unconstitutional, excuse me. And at that time, then Judge Brett Kavanaugh wrote the opinion for the panel, and it was his recommendation that that just be stricken from Title 10. So it is a departure, and it's interesting. And I think it's actually, as I've been reading this, probably correct, because if you look at the severability clause in Dodd-Frank, it's not in Title 10, it's in the general portion of Dodd-Frank, and I think it's 53, sorry, I got so many windows up here, I can't remember what I have here. It's in 5302 of Dodd-Frank, and it says if any portion of this act, an amendment made by this act, or the application of such provision or amendment to any person or circumstance is held to be unconstitutional, the remainder of the act, the amendments made by the act, and the application of the provisions of such to any person or circumstance shall not be affected thereby. So I think that's interesting, and I think the court was correct because they really need to look at it holistically. And I know we're going to talk about, you know, what outcomes, and I'll wait to have that conversation, but I think it's really important that everybody think about that section and how the Supreme Court is going to reconcile that.
Well, you know, Joanne, just to follow up on that, I went back and looked at, and I know you have, and our other panelists have as well, at what now Justice Kavanaugh was saying and doing when mm-hmm. he was with the D.C. Circuit and dealing with the mm-hmm. PHH matter. And, you know, my read of that, and I think it's also reflected in some of the commentary I was reviewing and, mm-hmm. and different interpretations, was that, yes, he was willing to sever and not find the entire act unconstitutional, but I also think he felt bound, and rightfully so, by the Supreme mm-hmm. Court's precedent in Humphrey's executor, but now mm-hmm. he's on the court himself. So that's why mm-hmm. I find it very interesting, and I'm mm-hmm. wondering if I actually spent some time mapping out who's on the court and where are they, and, you know, mm-hmm. one of the things I'm wondering, because I know, and we're going to talk about this more later, but I'm wondering if I don't know that there's a necessarily a decision in either Justice Kavanaugh or Justice Roberts' mind. And I think that those are the people that and I'm not a Supreme Court practitioner. I'm not even barred in that court. But I'm wondering if those might be the justices that when all the dust settles, if those are the ones that are the ones we should be focusing on speaking to in this decision.
So this is Bedard. Just to give our listeners some context here, Celia Law is a law firm debt settlement company against whom the CFPB has issued CIDs. They're investigating this law firm. The law firm did respond to the CIDs, but didn't respond in a way that the Bureau considered to be adequate. And as a result, the Bureau sued Celia Law to enforce the CIDs. They asked the federal judge to compel them to respond to the CIDs. The district judge before whom that petition was filed granted the petition and commanded Celia Law to respond to the CID. With some exceptions, they narrowed some of the topics a little bit. Celia Law appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals after a bunch of analysis on the constitutionality, on and on and on, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals affirms the district judge decision and commands Celia Law to respond to the CID. That brings us to where we are today, which is where Celia Law then goes one step further and files a petition asking the U.S. Supreme Court to take the case on appeal And we just learned a week or two ago that the Supreme Court has agreed to take that case. And so the context here is that the Supreme Court is going to hear whether or not CFPB is constitutionally structured, because that was the issue before both the district judge and the Court of Appeals. Moreover, the Supreme Court issued another directive to the parties and says, yes, we'll hear your case, and we're just not going to hear the question that was raised in this case. We're also directing the parties here to be prepared to talk about and to advise the court and brief the issue on what the consequence is of an unconstitutionally structured CFPB. And so to say it a different way, parties, be prepared to tell us whether or not simply removing the offending language from Dodd-Frank is the solution in the event we find the CFPB to be unconstitutional. That's the background. That's the posture of the case right now. And so I think I share the excitement of Joanne and Stephanie about the prospect of hearing what the Supreme Court has to say about the constitutionality of the Bureau.
This is Joanne. You're 100% right, John, but I think what's interesting is that I think they stopped short, though, and I know that there were motions for leave to file amicus, and there was also a request by All American Check Cashing, who is presently before the Fifth Circuit on this issue, as well as Ocwen, to reconsider and possibly join in this case. There's a lot of talk about, so what's the remedy? And I don't, as I read the certiorari order, and I look at the question presented by Celia, I am a little concerned that while we may get to the issue of constitutionality, we may get to the issue of how it is severed, I am not so sure we're going to get to an issue of what the remedy would be.
So if the Supreme Court doesn't address that issue, then the consequence will be that they could find that the Bureau is unconstitutionally structured, but they're going to have to make a decision on whether to affirm the Ninth Circuit's order to the law firm to respond to the CID or not. And so even if, as you suggest, could be the consequence, which is that they don't tell us what the consequence of a constitutional infirmity is, what do you think that means in terms of whether the Bureau, the Supreme Court would affirm or overturn the Ninth Circuit's command to this law firm to respond to the CID?
Well, I don't think they're connected. I think that they can say, all right, it's unconstitutional. Law firm, you do not have to respond because it's an unconstitutional structure, especially if it's a Kavanaugh or a Judge Roberts who's writing the opinion. Especially if it's Judge Kavanaugh, having listened to some of his prior speeches, he makes it very clear. I wrote in my notes last night when I was watching something, the Supreme Court cannot legislate. And so I think there may be a directive as to whether, a directive to Congress fix it. And I think Congress is going to have to do that. I don't think that the court, given who the writers of this opinion will be, will think up a solution. In fact, that's not what someone like a Kavanaugh or a Roberts would ever want from a court. That would be activist, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Joanne, to your point about the remedy, maybe I'll venture a little bit further.
Yeah.
And that's why I was mentioning Roberts and Kavanaugh, those being mm-hmm. maybe the two justices that are really pivotal here, and how they ultimately are persuaded by the briefs, the arguments, the discussions with their co-justices, the other members of the court. Because I sit here and say, all right, let's step back. Let's say that the court decides that it is unconstitutional as structured, and that you have to at least get rid of the four costs. Mm-hmm. And on the one hand, you could sever it and leave the rest of the statute intact, which is just for purposes of this discussion. Let's assume that is something that the more, what are generally understood to be the more liberal justices, Sotomayor, Kagan, Ginsburg, Breyer, let's assume they're on board with that, right? Because they most likely, not for sure, but I'm thinking that's going to align with some of their jurisprudence. And then I'm going to assume for purposes of this, that Gorsuch, Thomas, and Alito, I wouldn't be surprised to hear them supporting the alternative of the whole thing should go. This isn't severable. This isn't proper. This isn't what to your point, Joanne, what the court is supposed to do. We're not, and we think Congress, looking at some of their prior opinions and things over time and, mm-hmm. and what they've expressed, Congress may have overstepped here, and it isn't for us to fix it. Congress needs to fix it. So I was like, all right, on the one hand, if we have it's just severed, and it looks like what Justice Kavanaugh wrote in the subsequently overturned opinion on the D.C. Circuit, everything just kind of continues, right? The Bureau remains. It doesn't mean we don't make arguments about whether there are collateral impacts as to prior orders. I mean, that I'm putting that aside, but it remains in place, and it will presumably, and I think this, well, I don't know. I initially thought that this would probably be the position it would take of its prior orders, et cetera, remain intact, and going forward, we're going to continue to fulfill the role that we were given by Congress, which is something we've heard from prior acting director Mulvaney and the current director, Kraninger. I mean, they do believe in the fulfilling the mission of an agency that exists, right? And they take that role, I think, in the execution of that role very seriously, and in a way that may transcend, and I hope transcends, political alignment. But on the flip side, let's look at the other side, because the more I prepped and the more I thought, the more I was like, gosh, a lot of these justices, I'm wondering if they will, if five of them are going to go where we say it's all gone. So what does that mean? Well, it means it's all gone. And everything that was done in the mortgage space, all the rule, all of that is just gone. Yeah. And what does that mean? And then it gets an even more convoluted, because you look back at prior cases like Morrison versus Olson, which dealt with the Independent Counsel Act. And this was on the Rehnquist Court. None of the current justices were on it other than, well, he's not a current justice now, but the late Justice Scalia. But a lot of people that are on the current court are really what I would call Scalia disciples. And Scalia was the only dissenting opinion to that said it was really improper for somebody to be able to be outside the control of the president, i.e. an independent counsel. And I look right now at what's going on with the impeachment and what went on with the Mueller investigation and just thinking about the environment we're in, I think that you might be really on to something, Joanne, that the court may say this is gone and kick it back to Congress to come up with the remedy. And you know what made me kind of, as I'm prepping, get there, and honestly, the reason I'm hesitating a little is, while that could be an intellectually very interesting environment to be in as a lawyer, it's kind of unsettling. I mean, that I've always said, I think the most likely outcome is what Kavanaugh already wrote. But Justice Roberts has in an interview that I came across as I was preparing, so I was trying to figure out where are these other justices going to fall, or is there anything I can point to? And there was a statement he made about one of the things that's the most difficult for the court in the current environment. And this was maybe a year or two ago. I don't have the site in front of me now, but he was remarking and said that the discord that continues between the legislative branch, i.e. Congress, and the executive branch, mm-hmm. i.e. the president, is making decision-making even harder for the court. And he was talking about just generally how to operate in a politicized environment and with ideological alignment on the Supreme Court. And that hit me. Wow, that's interesting, because it sounds like what you are already saying, there may be enough justices on this court that just don't think it is appropriate for them to be coming up with that remedy.
Right. Okay. Interesting. Great. Go ahead, John.
I was just going to make sure that our listeners had a good understanding of what the issue is in Dodd-Frank, because I don't think we mentioned it at the beginning.
Sure.
Dodd-Frank, requires the president to appoint the director of the Bureau with the advice and consent of the Senate. However, when you go farther down into the next section, it says that the president may remove the director for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance. And so the director does not serve at the will of the president. The president can't, for any reason or no reason at all, fire the director. The president has to have a reason which is related to inefficiency, neglect, or malfeasance in office. And the reason why that's the offending language in the statute is because the Constitution bestows the entire executive power of the government in a single person, which is the president, who has the obligation to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And the argument is that by giving somebody executive authority, like the director of the CFPB, but not making that person subject to the will of the president, invades the president's obligations to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. It's an inhibition to the president's authority, right? It invades the president's authority. So that's the constitutional issue. Is Congress allowed to create positions for which they have executive authority, but for which the president does not have unfettered discretion to fire them? That's the issue here. And so I wanted to make sure everybody understood it, because I have a tendency to sort of get into the minutiae and the jargon without actually laying out the issue first. And so there we have the issue. Dodd-Frank potentially invades the president's power, which upsets the balance of power in our